Good morning, cricket fans, and welcome to the Catch It podcast.
Oh, what a catch!
I'm Andrew Lush, and I started this podcast to have some interesting and insightful conversations about analytics and the stats behind the action, and to develop myself as a presenter.
Good!
Oh, actually, oh, brilliant!
I hope you enjoy our discussions and debates.
That is an absolutely outstanding catch.
Okay, Dan Weston, welcome to the Catch It podcast. How are you doing today?
Yeah, great to be on. Thanks for having me. Really good. Getting there better every day. So, looking forward to the cricket season starting in UK in about 2 months' time, I suppose.
It's nice to have the days slightly getting a bit brighter, a bit less rain. In terms of how's your winter been, apart from the obvious, the unfortunate, you've been in the hospital a couple of times, but apart from that side, how has it been in the winter?
Well, that's kind of scuppered my plans in terms of like winter work and stuff like that. Mm. So I didn't really put myself forward for anything because obviously I had some health battles to fight. I was in hospital for just over 2 months in total. So but feeling good now. I think fingers crossed, touch wood, everything is like on the way to recovery. It's going to take a little more bit of a while, but hopefully by about start of April, they say that I should be pretty much like back to normal. So that's good timing for the cricket season as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's great to hear. And it's great to hear that you're on the mend. Yeah. So we're going to go all the way back. And in terms of just kind of piecing from my research together about where your introduction into cricket was, you used to be a professional poker player. Now tell me about the lifestyle of a professional poker player, because the only person that jumps to mind quite ineptly from me is Victoria Mitchell, David Mitchell's wife. So that was the first thing that kind of came to my mind. So how did you fall into being a professional poker player, and what did that involve?
Well, I think everyone's got their own kind of journey through that, who's done that type of thing. I know that for example, Victoria Mitchell is, I think she does a lot of like live tournaments in casinos and stuff like that, and I never really did a great deal of that. I did a few, but it's not for me. With when you're looking at it from a management perspective, it wasn't really the most time efficient way to spend my time. So for me, I would just like multi-table like 6 or 8 tables online, like day in, day out. And so I'd have like a multi-screen setup and stuff, and I'd have software running, which kind of gives me data on my opposition and stuff as well, which is completely legal. It's just software you pay for that runs in the background. And you get traits of your opposition, basically,
that you can, you can assess who you are playing against.
So I used to do that, like multi-table, like kind of mid-stakes, which was actually, when you look at it, people call it mid-stakes, but actually, because you're playing like 6 or 8 tables, you actually got quite a lot of money in play at any one time. However, because you're playing so many tables and so many hands per hour, you're spreading the risk a lot more. It's like almost like a diverse portfolio rather than like going all in for the same amount of money, if that makes sense, in like a big tournament or massive cash game or something like that. So actually it was kind of a better risk management strategy. And
you're not thinking this hand needs to come off because you've got such a diverse range.
Yeah. You drop a buy-in, you just move on because you've got a lot of buy-ins in play over a lot of tables. The other thing would be that you've got a lot of sort of bankroll management guides online, so you're really not really ever putting more than say no more than like 2% of your bankroll on a table at any one time and stuff like that. So like there's ways to structure it so that you can minimize your risk. And then back in the day when I was doing it a lot, it was the glory days of poker when like Full Tilt was in its pomp, and I had like an insane rate back deal as well.
Your day would be setting all this up, running your software, and working out where opposition would be kind of efficient or inefficient in their strategies.
So you would like for want of a better phrase, it's a phrase that people would use more at that time, would be like fish hunt. So like, I'll target certain players basically that I've played against before, and you can color code all the players and on the software, and they pop up in the lobby when they pop up in the lobby, and it's like, right, okay, this guy's purple, must have played against him before, he's really bad or something like that, you know, like color coded him. And then with the rate back deal, so rate back, I mean, even if you broke even but you played a really high volume of hands, you'd still make a good monthly living, because you're getting like a payout at the end of the month for the rate that you've generated. So like if you have like 50% rate back deal, at the end of the month you would get like 50% of the rate that you've generated back in one lump sum.
Interesting.
So like basically even if you broke even, like you would still be a winning player. So
you're playing the percentages, right? And you're making sure you're playing enough for that number to be high.
There was people who, I mean, I couldn't do it. I tried. There was people who played like 16 or 20 tables at the same time. And they literally, their objective was just to break even. But then at the end of the month, they would get like this huge payout into their bank account for the rate they've generated, because they're playing so many hands and so many tables.
Wow. And how did that kind of, I can see how the strategy and the kind of various different risk-taking elements of that are so comparable to competitive sport.
Mm-hmm.
How, absolutely. When you're, sorry again.
No, that's just agreeing with you. Yeah, basically, you're absolutely right.
When did that kind of become apparent in terms of you could compare this to professional sport, or to kind of working into how you could, right, this has a comparable lane into building a team or building kind of a franchise or like a team structure?
I think the first learning that you really take from say playing poker seriously full time is that you can make good decisions that don't come off, and you can make bad decisions that still work. Like you could get your money in as like 80-20 favorite, you're still going to lose one in five times. If you get your money as a 20-80 underdog, you're still going to win one in five times. But you might have made a bad decision to get your money in that spot, but you're still going to win sometimes. And actually, you can make peace with a lot of decisions that you might make in, say, recruitment or match strategy, matchups, for example, things like that, because actually you've got this really, really good level of experience that actually you can do everything right and still lose. Like the world's best poker player could have a day where they can't win a hand. That can happen. And it's no different. Like you can make every strategic decision right, but you get the variance and bad luck on your side. I mean, I remember a game a couple of years ago at Leicester when I was there. Obviously, I'm not there anymore, but I think it was against Durham, first T20 game of the season. And I felt that strategically we were very, very good in that game, bowling wise, kind of second guessed them a lot for matchups. But then when they basically hit every false shot or uncontrolled error shot, just flies off for six or goes in the middle of like two fielders and stuff like that, actually, there's really not a great deal that you can do. And you've got to make peace with that. And having that knowledge of poker where you could play really, really well and lose over a day, that's a key learning. And then also I would say that experience in tournaments helps a lot with like the draft and particularly the auction environments as well. So what I learned very quickly in poker is that like if you play, you can lose a tournament in the first one or two, three rounds, but you can't win a tournament in that. So when I did the IPL auction, I was very keen to like not overcommit early in the auction in terms of bidding. So I relayed that sort of strategy back to a few people. And actually, then you can maybe after, say, two or three rounds when everyone's gone crazy and bust their budget or spent a lot of their budget, you can play big stack strategy and bully people.
Yeah.
It's kind of how it would work in poker.
Because those first couple of auction lots can go massively in terms of your first couple of rounds.
Hugely unpredictable. And I think that a lot of teams can really disadvantage themselves in like their flexibility for later rounds and later lots for players by the decisions that they make early. So I look at it quite a lot from like a game theory perspective in that respect. So as well, it's the stamina issue as well. So like the IPL mega auction is like 2 days long. It's you're there early, you're finishing late.
An insane amount of time to be thinking strategically all that time.
Yeah, 100%. And poker tournaments are like that. You can't switch off for a second, because if you do, something disastrous could happen. And it's no different with an auction, really. You've got to be bang on it for a long, long amount of hours every 2 days in a row, potentially. It's like a kind of multi-day poker tournament, really. There's a lot of similarities in terms of the dynamics of it all, comparing to like blind rounds in poker and auction sets in the IPL auction, for example.
It's interesting as well how the strategy plays out. If you keep the way you're talking about there, if you keep yourself in the game long enough, you can get a bigger payout, or your strategy can go longer than if you use all your resources early. So in terms of how did you get into, from my research, I think you started with the T10. Is that correct?
No. I started doing like a lot of sort of private stuff early for freelancing and stuff. For the T10 was like the first overseas job I got, but I'd done a lot of work for teams for quite a few years before then, like just recruitment
consultancy work, kind of roles.
Yeah, exactly.
How they ran their auction.
Yeah, and then I joined Leicester in 2020, so then did 2 years there, and then I'm in my second year at Kent now.
So as the county role always, so since 2020, you've always had kind of a county working relationship with county. And then obviously outside of that, you've got your T10 experience. And then we'll talk about it a bit, as we've briefly touched on. We'll talk about later your role in the IPL auction.
Yeah.
Going over to the T10, T10's a draft, which is very different strategy. How did you prepare for that in terms of how different for your perfect team in terms, because I know a lot of things can change in terms of coach requirements or ownership requirements. And I mean, I know as you smile there, Riley, for your perfect team, how do you go about it building a T10 team versus a T20 team?
Okay. So, this is interesting. I only did 1 year in T10. I think if you look back on the players that we recruited, so myself and Canal Manick, who's the analyst at Knotts and Trent Rockets, we did the work together. And I think that it would be fair to say that since we did the recruitment just over 2 years ago, a lot of the picks that we made at low price points have aged pretty well. So, for example, we gave Luke Wood his first overseas contract. We picked up Will Jacks for cheap money. We picked up Will Smith for cheap money. We picked up Matisha Patarana as an emerging player, but he couldn't end up playing. So we picked Tom Hartley as a replacement. So like these players have all gone on to play
well in franchise leagues and
definitely improve their reputation over the last couple of years. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I was kind of put into a situation where actually some players had already been retained, so like I couldn't do a great deal about that. But I think that the players that we recruited on the whole did very, very, very well. I think that, as you say, there are different requirements, and I definitely have my eyes opened a little bit to how that can work in terms of like the ownership dynamic and the coach dynamic and stuff. Was interesting one, definitely a learning experience. But how I went about it to start, so Cooney would do a lot of his work would be like more video analysis and technical stuff, whereas I would do a lot of like modeling, and I built like a T10 model which had expected performance levels and stuff. So what, for example, one of the reasons why I was very keen on the Luke Wood piece of recruitment was that he had a really low expected concession of sixes based on his T20 data. So I would model according to the T10 basically how historical players had converted certain performances to the T10 level across different leagues, and he was expected to concede a low percentage of sixes, which is really key in terms of the requirements for that particular tournament. Small boundary,
because you're wanting to keep that boundary percentage down low.
Yeah, so and then that brings you on nicely to your batting lineup as well. Whereas you've got to have players who are comfortable from ball one in boundary hitting, and you've got to have perhaps players who can complement each other. And I think in that league in particular, it might have changed a little bit this year, but definitely in the conditions in 2021, end of 21, and I think in 2022 as well, it was a very pace-oriented league. So you had players who were very comfortable hitting boundaries off paces early in their innings. Spin didn't really have much of an impact, apart from the guys, a bit like Hartley, actually, who fires it in, quite a tall player, and bowls pretty quickly for a spinner and just looks to just fire it in. They tend to do better at those type of spinners, tend to do better in T10 than like the loopy ones, if that makes sense. Like the guys who are trying to get a lot more turn and stuff.
Is that because there's an element of you don't have a longer middle period that potentially batters are able to knock it around, or in terms of focus on strike rotation, and it's harder to hit boundaries because that middle period is completely shrunk? Spinners, like a wrist spinner, when it goes wrong, they can be a bit more kind of taken on.
I think because there's a floating power play, you never really know
that's going to come into play.
Gonna happen. Yeah, exactly. So you've always got a middle over where there's going to be a power play, pretty much. But I think for me, more is the key point is to those type of spinners make it harder for the batters to go aerial against them. And when batters are, in theory, your opposition batters are going to be playing with very high intent, it's critical to bowl those type of balls where they're going to really struggle to get under it and get a lot of power under it as well. So there's certain type of players who I think thrive more in a T10 environment. Some of the recruitment in that league is weird. I don't just mean weird. I mean like very ill-informed. So like you get guys, teams will routinely recruit guys who are like below average blast boundary hitters, which is just crazy. Why would you do that
when it's a T10 league built on boundary hitting?
I could give you like a list of 50 players who off the top of my head who would be better at that particular role that is required at that time.
Has been working in the T10 influenced how you work in, for example, another shorter than T20 comp, the 100? Has that influenced your theories and strategy in working for that draft? Because they're two, obviously, shorter than T20, but still kind of the 100 is a little bit longer. But if you can get that batter who can hit boundaries for longer, is that what you're kind of, did that influence you going back to a longer, shorter format?
Yeah, it was interesting because the 100 came first in 2019.
Oh, okay.
Right. 2019, so end of 2019. Obviously, then the tournament got delayed. But the T10, I think, had run for a good couple of seasons, if not three, before or the first draft of 100. So actually, I was able to kind of model how teams dealt with less resources in terms of balls available to them, but still with the same amount of wickets in hand, how that they up the intent, to what degree, what is there like a sweet spot between 120 balls and 60 balls that you can kind of then find a sweet spot for 100 balls, for example. I did stuff like modeled average winning scores and average scores, power play scores, whatever, And there was certainly, I felt that insight was really useful for building the squad that we had in year one, which obviously building from scratch, where we were very, very keen to recruit a specific type of player. And that was based on a lot of research, but from trying to understand the difference between T20 and T10, and then 100 is sort of roughly in the middle of that, or not far off the, anyway. I hadn't worked in T10, and I still used a lot of the data from T10 to kind of formulate strategies and stuff for the 100. So because I'd done the 100, by the time I'd done T10, I didn't really need to use the T10 in terms of the actual life experience to understand the 100. Yeah, it already happened by that point.
Yeah. It's interesting in terms of when you're looking at players with a high boundary percentage and how they are picked up or undervalued sometimes in auctions. Do you think that will change as we go on to, we're playing more and more white ball tournament, picking up how Will Jacks has been tracked in his progression? Just an example of a batter who is now performing really well in the SA20 and has performed well for you in the T10 and done well in the 100. Yeah. Do you think it's going to be looking at younger players who have that potential to hit boundaries more often, and you'll recruit from that? That will become more of a model.
I think that that's certainly where the smart plans will be. I think that there's a fair bit of distance to travel before that becomes a kind of saturated modus operandi, if you like. At the moment, teams just make so many mistakes with the recruitment. They have contrasting objectives. They're still very agent-driven, which I think is crazy. You know, they'll still listen to like agent recommendations of players and stuff, which is just nuts. So there's a lot of knowledge that needs
conflicting noise around recruitment at the moment, especially at like franchise level.
And also the fact that there's two other key points is the fact that the people are still quite reticent to employ or to pay decent money for someone who can actually really help them achieve those kind of marginal gains in the recruitment market. Also, I think that there needs to be more jeopardy in T20 leagues for that to happen, or to accelerate that process. Because at the moment,
more reward for winning, or
both. Yeah, reward for winning and implications for failing. I don't see that promotion and relegation is going to happen in a major T20 league anytime soon, but I think it should. And that certainly would focus minds very, very quickly. And certainly reduce the tolerance for failure or continued failure from teams. What I would say is that at the moment there's not really a massive incentive for teams to have a lot of skin in the game, to make decisions which are going to really improve their on-pitch product and performance. Because at the moment, they can just like hire a big name and just like use them for marketing, and the owner gets rich. But there's no downside for them apart from the fact that the teams just lose games. But the owner still want to make money. So
yeah, so it's just there's no competition in that sense. Do you think?
Yeah, and there's no accountability or implications for failure. It's not like football where like a guy like Frank Lampard when he was at Everton. Like, he had the most horrendous record as head coach. And that was, like, plastered all over the media and social media and stuff like that. Like, there was the sort of level of scrutiny was far bigger than what you would see in cricket. Yeah, there are coaches who probably, I think, if you looked at their record over the last few years, it would shock a lot of people.
Do you think just quick point. Do you think implementing something like bringing back? I listened to I think it's Backward Point podcast, and they talked about how they would bring back the Champions League T20, which was all the winners and runners up of T20 leagues all playing in one big competition. I think it struggled for I think it struggled for broadcasting. It struggled for making sure teams made to it. But something like that, to so an actual winning a league meant something. Do you think that would help with the kind of the ownership of how well a team did or how didn't they do well?
I do think that would have scope for improving that level of motivation to do well on the pitch for owners. So, but you'd have to throw like a pretty decent amount of money at it. So like, yeah, maybe if there's like, I don't know, $10 or $20 million first prize for winning on the Champions League or something like that, actually, they might be really quite driven to start looking at marginal gains a lot more. Or even if it's just like, yeah, couple of million just for qualifying or whatever it might be. Like, it's actually, you know how it is in football. You know, you get money for just turning up in the Champions League. Mm. You've got to earn the right to do that first. Mm. And yeah, I definitely think that. I think there'll be some logistical hurdles to overcome. the fact that players play for multiple teams. Yeah. Personally, how I would approach that would be that you have to play for your domestic team.
Mm. So if you played for your, so for example, Will Jacks couldn't play for Delhi, couldn't play for Delhi's the Capitals for this SA20, he'd have to play for his 100 team.
Yeah, he'd exactly. Yeah. Because he's the domestic player for that team.
Mm. Yeah.
And you've got to do it like that. I think that would be the only way you could logistically navigate through that.
Yeah, pull that all together. Moving on, you'd had experience in county cricket with Leicestershire, had experience with T10 franchise cricket. How was it getting asked, in terms of how did it come about that you were employed by the Punjab 11? The Punjab Kings 11. There we go. It's a bit of a mouthful. So how did it come about that you were employed by the Punjab Kings 11 to do their auction? Was it the mega auction or was it a mini auction that you were involved in? The
mega auction in February 2022. There's I have had some chats with Shankar Rajgopal, who was working with the team at the time in terms of the analytics side of things. He was amazing to work with and incredibly smart guy. And I think that there was a desire from some people at the team to have an independent voice rather than someone who kind of been immersed in like the Indian cricket system over a long period of time. Maybe had bad habits. Yeah, like unconscious bias or something like that. Yeah. Whereas like, I could come in from England and it would be completely different. Like I wouldn't have favourites basically. Or
you'd have a neutral opinion coming in, which can be very helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So there was that desire to have that independent viewpoint, and we worked really really hard actually before the auction. I mean, like definitely. We put the work in, and I think that actually it's been a real shame that the management group after that first season was kind of jettisoned. Because I think again, similarly to what I said about T10 as well, a lot of the players that we bought at auction have aged pretty well in terms of their profile and their value. You know, you've got guys like Prabhsimran Singh, Jitesh Sharma. It was just named two players who were picked up, you know, relatively cheap, especially Jitesh at base price. And now, you know, Prab got 100 last year in the IPL. Jitesh is now playing for India. You know, these picks were good. We picked up Nathan Ellis as well, who was there actually before, but again, came back at a cheap price. He's done really, really well across the world. So, you know, a lot of the kind of budget picks that we got have done pretty well, enhanced their reputation, definitely enhanced their market value. So, you know, that's I think it's a shame that wasn't allowed to develop into a longer term project, if that makes sense. And I still get messages from Punjab fans sometimes, which is pretty nice, basically saying it was the most exciting squad that they construct.
You just wish you'd been able to go into like a mini auction to kind of shuffle the pack a little bit and learn from the previous year.
I just think that actually, no, it's not even that so much. I think it's just that sometimes it takes time.
Yeah, agreed.
Having one season after a mega auction where if Rahul Tuatia doesn't hit 2 sixes off the last 2 balls, you qualify. And actually, if that changes, then you get probably do get the extra time. So and then there's a lot of sliding doors moments in cricket. Like,
yeah.
Definitely. Very, very short term outcomes can influence someone's career.
Yeah. That's the toughness with franchise cricket.
As like, you know, working in support staff or management of teams, whether you're that or you're a player, 2 or 3 balls sometimes can decide a lot in terms of your career. Didn't do, but it does.
Yeah, it's the devil of sports management and in the professional sports circuit. Yeah, really, no doubt.
Yeah, like it's probably no different to like a football manager who gets sacked because they concede last minute equaliser. If they'd have won, he would have got like 3 more games minimum or something like that. And then if he wins 1 or 2 of them, then he gets like the rest of the season or something like that, you know? But some random header from a set piece or something goes in the 95th minute and suddenly he gets sacked.
Do you think, as you talked about earlier, in terms of your poker has helped you just be calm with those kind of results in terms of you've done, you're happy that you get to a moment that you're pretty happy with your stats, happy with your strategy, you've built this team, now they have to go play the game and you're pretty happy just sitting down and being like quite neutral. Do you think poker has helped that? Because I think I'm still struggling with that.
I wouldn't say happy. in terms of happy to watch stuff without having an impact. Actually, as it happens, I do feel that the more you do it, the easier it is to cope with the fact that once the game starts, you really, there isn't really a great deal that you can influence. Whether you're sitting at home on the table, you can't influence anything then. But if you're in a dugout, even like there's not really a huge amount that you can influence at that point. I think for me now, I would get more frustrated if process wasn't followed rather than actual outcome. Yeah. So that's much more important to me. I'd rather lose. If I've got to lose, I want to lose the right way.
Yeah, agreed. You want to be playing an aggressive brand.
Yeah, sticking to a principle like that. The reason why we've recruited players and set up in a certain way. Now, you know, funnily enough, I'm a Tottenham fan. We've seen that this year.
Oh, dear. I'm an Arsenal fan, Dan. Oh, gosh.
I wonder why you had the red microphone.
I mean, it's more because of lengths, but I'll let you finish your point.
He just sticks to the way he wants to play. No matter what. You go down to 9 men against Chelsea, but he still plays the same way. Because that's what he.
I do have respect for your new manager. I have to say, I didn't like Mourinho. I didn't like Pochettino really, but I do have respect for him in terms of he does look like he has a style of football he wants to play, and he's not gonna, if the game changes, he's not gonna veer away from it.
No.
Or even if he's under pressure, he's not gonna veer away from it. Which I can, as tough as it is to say from an Arsenal perspective, I can respect that.
Yeah.
In terms of management and making decisions that you're comfortable with and you're happy with.
Yeah, and I think it's important because you have that consistency with players that you don't deviate from the way you want to play and the brand of style of play that you want to implement. Because otherwise that just creates doubt if you start ditching a style of play when it goes wrong. And yeah, that's definitely important. And I think that also with him, I think he doesn't tolerate failure. He doesn't tolerate years. But if you work for him, you will love working for him. If you're the right personality and you play the game the right way, you'll love working for him. And I think there's a lot to be said for stuff like that, even in cricket as well. Like, culture-wise is something that I've spent a lot of time working on, especially when I was actually in hospital. I spent a lot of time looking at how football teams work on certain areas and how they might approach certain problems, how they build culture.
And that's taking it slightly away from the mathematical part.
100%.
And building it into how humans react to certain pressure situations and how that can maybe come back to your statistics. How are you kind of, as a quite an analytical person, how are you attacking that problem or thinking over that problem?
Well, I think you can have a multifaceted approach. And I've never said that data is the all-encompassing answer to everything. Yeah. But if you had to choose between the data and the eye test and there was no middle ground, I would choose data. I'm not scared to say that. But in the ideal world, you would use a lot of factors to recruit, and data will just be one layer of that. Predictive analytics or whatever you want to call it. And then you do a lot of research. I'm quite fortunate now in men's cricket, at least, like there's probably at most like 1 degree of separation between me and any player, basically, pretty much, definitely in England and in other countries as well. So basically, I can message one person who will know that person.
It's interesting when you get through that layer of the upper echelons, how interesting you can get to those conversations and working out how different players they think and how they kind of they work. I don't think that's talked about enough as analysts in terms of how communication to different styles of players is really important. Have you found that as you kind of developed in your career, that how you communicate to different people changes in what you kind of give them?
Yeah, I think so. I think language is very important. I think communication is extremely important. How I would talk to you if we were having a conversation on analytics is not how I present the same situation to a player. So instead of percentages, you might, for sake of argument, you're saying, okay, in this game, we've got to hit 20% boundaries to win. You might rephrase that to a player and say, well, throughout our innings, we've got to go 1 in 5 balls, because you're not framing it as a percentage, you're framing it as an area that they'll understand a little bit more. It's more relatable to the player. I find that players generally, they like you when you're positive. They don't want to be overloaded with stuff unless they ask you. So I have a kind of a rule whereby I'll be light with the players unless they specifically ask me. And then if it comes...
Unless you have a badger or someone who really wants to know.
If they ask you to critique them or plan stuff for them, then I feel like that's kind of the green light to go into a lot more detail. And especially if they turn around and say, where can I improve? Well, the first thing I'll say to them is, look, I might not tell you everything that you want to hear, but are you cool with that? And they will say yes, because they come to you to start with.
Yeah. It's building that trust, which is key to know that you can have that conversation.
Yeah. But then there's some players who are not interested in the slightest. My view is that that's a mistake. And my view is that those players are going to struggle in the future, because the player market with all these leagues going around the world is going to be becoming more and more competitive. More and more countries are starting to play at a higher level. Associate teams now are really starting to break through and pick up, surprise results at World Cups and stuff like that. We've got a T20 World Cup in a few months' time, and you could definitely see upsets happening, or theoretical upsets, or whatever you want to call it. So the player pool is getting bigger and it's more competitive, and the rewards for a player, if they're successful, is huge. So why wouldn't you really try and maximize your level of output and your, or expected level of output and your talent, by understanding more about yourself and understanding more about the opposition? So, I mean, if a player doesn't want to know, that's fine.
It's fine. It is what it is.
But let's say that I'm in more of a decision-making role for a team, then they need to be held accountable for a performance. I'll hold them accountable for their performance if they don't perform and they're not listening. They're not willing to listen.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It's a tough in-between, because there are younger, from my experience personally, there are younger players that are interested, and you need to kind of work out how you can get them interested. And there sometimes it's a bit of a stereotype, but there are older players who just this isn't how we've worked. And I think it's interesting how you've written a lot on your Substack, which is, I'll link in the bio below this, which I think is a really good, interesting read. Because I think in terms of, you're not afraid to put out the alternate or the controversial opinion. But I think sometimes in cricket, we have to have those conversations. I think sometimes I enjoy just throwing out wild kind of backed theories of how cricket's going to change stuff. So I think in terms of, it's quite interesting. You write a lot about how older players are, their perceived runs is very different to their actual runs. And in terms of their run rate decreasing.
Yeah.
What kind of, like, how did you get on to kind of creating like an article and research? So
there'll be a few different ways. So I'll have like theories or hypotheses that I want to test out. And bear in mind as well, just for anyone who's listening and doesn't know how this all started, is that, like, I taught myself from scratch. I've never been on any courses. I've never gone down like the formal pathway route, if that makes sense. But I actually think that's a good thing, because it means that I'm not kind of indoctrinated into certain mindsets, and I'm quite willing to challenge and be challenged. And if someone wants to challenge me, I full respect for that, but they better come back with a good argument, because I'll have everything on the hand as well at the same time. And that's fine too. That's fine. But what I would say is that, so I test a lot of theories out. So this might be something that an opinion that I formed over a long period of time. And I'm like, look, I want to work out like where the decline really starts in a player, for example, the average player. Like, you don't get me wrong, you've got guys who are outliers to that. But I'm talking as a general rule. That's all you can do, because you can never be certain about anything. And
I think that's sometimes where the numbers get misinterpreted.
100%.
I think as analysts, sometimes we're told that we are fortune tellers, when in actual fact, we're just looking at the marginal gains and the slight differences, and on the average.
Well, I've always
which said, is very different
in a level budget,
telling someone the future.
In a level budget T20 league, if you're winning over 60% of your games, you're doing really well. And that's how fine the margins are, a lot. Like, and you're going to have to make a lot of good decisions to win over 60% of your games in the long term. So actually, there's no guarantees. So, for example, like, going back to what I was saying about the hypotheses and stuff, I might have like this thought that I want to learn more about a player age curve, when they start to improve, when they start to decline, when they start to when they might have a breakthrough initially, then they have a down period, and then they've got to work through that to get better, because they get worked out initially and stuff like that. And one thing that I noticed a lot is that as players get older, their non-boundary run production drops in T20. So
So like the rotation.
Yeah, rotation or running sharp twos and stuff like that. It really drops off quite significantly for a lot of players. And actually, like, when they were sort of probably a little bit more in the dad's army phase, CSK were like notorious for that. And don't get me wrong, sometimes they made up for it in other areas, but it was a dynamic. And that's definitely the case. But I do think that the older players generally, and it goes, again, this goes against a lot of what I would say is perceived wisdom, is that I think older players generally are quite overvalued in T20. I'm not saying that there's not a role for them, but I'm saying that the teams are not necessarily alive to the decline of older players as much as they should be. There's definitely a lot of cases where players get one or two contracts too many, or one or two big contracts too many, as they clearly
decline. And we're talking about resources. Some franchises can put way too much resources to an older, more experienced player who has a big name.
Yeah, I mean, I can't name names, but I can tell you right now that there's people, players around the world who are now in massive decline, who are taking up significant proportions of their team's budget.
Of a team's budget and resources.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a list management mistake. But teams are a little bit too reticent to get rid of these guys. And actually, there's a lot of argument to suggest that by predicting that decline, you're actually allowing a rival, you're creating a situation, I should say, where a rival team can take that hit instead of you.
Yeah. So potentially, and just for anyone listening, we're talking, obviously we're not naming names, we're just theoretically, you could release your player A, another team can see, oh, that's a very respectable international player, they've got X amount on their record, pick them up, resources lost, and you can spend more of your resources on another player potentially who's coming up and coming, has great potential, that then your opposition can't grab off you because they don't have the freed resources.
Because and it goes back to the big stack argument that I was saying earlier about poker. Because you've got more resources than they have, you can push more for a guy who's maybe a year or two before peak age or around peak age or something like that, who you wouldn't have been able to afford if had you made that kind of emotional decision to retain a guy who's in decline.
Yeah. I think it's interesting where that meets in terms of the way you talk about cricket. And some people don't always want to talk about it, but in terms of what resources a franchise has and how you go about building a team, is you've got to be kind of quite cutthroat with it. This is how we are going to progress as a franchise. This is how we're going
to
win.
Yeah. So go back to something that I'm sure people are listening that they'll remember, the old Moneyball film where Billy Bean doesn't travel with the team for like away games and stuff because he has to steer clear of player relationships because he has to cut them. And that's where I think American sport and to an extent soccer, football, whatever you want to call it, English Premier League, is much more advanced than cricket in terms of they're much more comfortable taking these decisions about when to jettison a player at the right time. You look at, the greatest manager in football in my lifetime has been Sir Alex Ferguson. I don't support Man United, but I think that it would be foolish to say that anyone, to have a different argument to that. But he did a number of rebuilds throughout his time at Manchester United. And he wasn't
afraid to tear it down.
He wasn't scared to tear it down. He wasn't scared to say a big name, right? You're done here. I'm finished with you. Whether it was Roy Keane or David Beckham, I read the other day about him dropping Steve Bruce before a cup final, and that was it. He did it with Jaap Stam, so many players. And a lot of the time, two or three of them at the same time for a big rebuild. And I think he was kind of the master at predicting when the shelf life of a player at that environment had come to an end. And I don't see that a lot in cricket.
Yeah, interesting. It's interesting how, but then in terms of if, for example, an older player does still have maybe 1 year on their contract, or if they've been released and you think, right, for one, other people, like in the Moneyball, I can't remember the player, but the Moneyball film, in one player, everyone had released him because of injuries or because of his age, that sometimes you can actually make a less risky choice in terms of bringing him in because he still has that year he still has that year that he could potential, but you just have to bring him in on a shorter contract. and be quite realistic with your expectations of him in your franchise.
100%.
Do you think that sometimes happens to play like devil's advocate and the reverse on that?
Okay, so I have no problem with signing a declining player on a short-term, low-value contract. But the problem is that doesn't happen very often. The players are still getting a long-term, valuable contracts.
When that could be used elsewhere.
That's the divide, and that's where your resources, as you say, could be used elsewhere. And where potentially teams are tying up resources on multi-year deals can't get out of.
So if you were, say, a blank franchise, would you more likely tie up your resources in... Well, it obviously this completely depends on so many variables, so I'm gonna rephrase that. Is it key to tie up your resources in a player that is only going to progress and develop and in a certain role that is always going to be a key part of your team's strategy? Is that where you would focus your resources rather than players that potentially don't match your strategy or don't, in terms of work, how you want to play to win games?
Definitely. That really aligns. So I've actually worked in part of the process of building on two teams from scratch, pretty much. So Birmingham Phoenix 2019, when you're building a franchise from the ground up, and you know, you have no players when you start. So you have to work out a lot in terms of strategy, identity, who fits your identity. Same in IPL, Punjab only retained Archdeep Singh and Mayank Agarwal before the mega auction, two players. So the rest of the squad, we had to build from scratch. And that means that you've got almost a blank page to go from finding, you work out who you want, what type of players you want, what skill sets important to you, what age dynamics important to you. Are you trying to build... A lot of people will try and build like a win-now team, I call it, a win-now team. Like, they don't care about 3 years down the line. They want to win now. But the problem is that's not future-proof, and that kind of screws the next person who takes charge of it, because they've got a lot of...
Because then you'll kind of correct those mistakes in a mini-auction.
100%, and you can't do that. In a mini-auction environment, it's really difficult, because... The best players are going for massive money because of scarcity of resources and those kind of auction dynamics that people refer to. And then you can't make mistakes. So I think from my perspective, I would say that both those teams that I was involved with building from kind of pretty much scratch, there would be definitely the thought process was to try and build a team that would be very competitive initially, but also would be kind of future-proofed as well.
So it had that longevity to kind of create a legacy after in the next tournament. Unfortunately, you didn't get there, but it would be able to carry on and be a good team in the long term, not just the short term.
Yeah, and as when you're working for a team, all you are is like a custodian of that team at that point in time. All you should be judged on is really whether you leave that team in a better state than when you started it. And you're helping the team progress even when you're not there. And I think that's really, really important. So I lean towards younger players a little bit. Not exclusively, but I generally find that's where the value is in the market a little bit more. And certainly in terms of finding players who might come on the journey with you and not cost that much money to start with and provide value for money over the short term at least. And I think young players now, as you mentioned earlier, they buy into kind of the analytics approach a bit more. They want to know a lot about themselves or the opposition. They've maybe been brought up in an environment where they're more sort of understand technology and being grown up in that, you know, a lot more computers and iPads and stuff at school and things like that, you know. Whereas, like, you know, a guy in the mid-30s probably didn't quite have that as much. And certainly anyone who's older than that didn't. I mean, I'm 44 now, and the computers we had at school were terrible.
Yeah. I was about to say, I don't think... Seeing it's quite interesting. I'm dyslexic, and I just, in terms of using tech and stuff, my life has been made 10 times easier with like software on laptops that helps me read to it. And it's interesting how that awareness of technology is so much greater sometimes in younger players.
Yeah.
Just to, so I think we,
sorry, it's like that the younger players, I think, are a little bit more, I suppose, willing to listen to your philosophies and to come on board with the way you want to play. You're not you're not asking, you know, teaching an old dog new tricks or whatever. They're actually they're actually willing to listen. So you can build potentially a 5 or 10 year team by picking good young players and letting them come for the journey. And then let's say you're fortunate enough to be in a position where you're at a club for a very long time, it becomes like a conveyor belt. So you've got guys,
and that goes back into the cultural thing. Cultural talk we're talking about.
Yeah, and my dream eventually would be to run a team where actually the personality of the players has to align with your methodology, your philosophy. And they all buy in as a collective to the way that the club wants to be run. And then you run like either a multi-club ownership model or an age pathway model, and everyone is playing the same way, like how Man City do at some point football. And if you're not willing,
way of playing cricket.
And if a player isn't willing to come along for the ride or to adhere to that style of play that you want to do, and they have to find somewhere else.
And it's quite interesting in terms of, we talk about that culture, is that it doesn't matter, and it's very much a different kind of culture, but similar. For example, the All Blacks, they have a set way of doing things and a set culture that has been proven to win. So if it doesn't matter how much individual talent a player coming through the pathway, if they can't accept those values, they won't fit in with the group, and they potentially won't get a spot in that team. Even it doesn't matter about talent, they won't fit in with how the organization work. And I think it's interesting how you talk about Man City as well, have a certain way they play, that what they want to go from first team right the way down. And cricket doesn't necessarily have that in terms of, and it's interesting, it doesn't have a kind of a style of play that you can see all the way down to a kind of a grassroots level in how they recruit and stuff from that. Just to, I think we could talk about this for hours, but just to kind of sum up and just kind of to finish off the pod, you've written a lot about your advice to young analysts. Would you say, from your experience, are you excited about where and how the, how cricket is set up for young analysts to get involved? Or do you think working in the industry has made you more kind of negative to how many kind of hurdles and roadblocks? Because I think sometimes I found it quite hard. When I tried to track back how I got my analyst role, there was a lot of uncertainty and there was a lot of different building steps. And when trying to give advice, it's quite hard. How do you feel about that at this point in time?
I mean, that's a really good question, and one that is really difficult to answer honestly, without coming across as being pretty negative.
That's the problem I find.
Look, I'll be honest. I find that the industry is pretty flaky. You get offered a lot that doesn't ever manifest itself into anything more concrete. I mean, I can tell you right now, I end up applying for a visa to go and work in PSL. And then got ghosted by the team who made me apply for the visa.
Yeah.
Like, stuff like that. I promised jobs left, right, and centre by certain people. And then I end up doing, like, a kind of an interim piece of work for them. And then you never hear anything more about it. It happens all the time. So I think from to give people a realistic understanding of the challenges that are involved, the key points for me is don't expect too much too soon. Don't believe everything that everyone tells you. There's certain types of people who I would definitely wouldn't listen to. That don't work for exposure, doesn't pay your mortgage. And very rarely will that manifest itself into to anything bigger than that. But people will try and get work for out of you for nothing, which has value because they promise you something that never manifests itself.
I'm not saying, and they're getting value for it.
I'm not saying
that you aren't.
I'm not saying that that there's not value in picking up, say, your first role for like no money or cheap if you can afford to do that. Because actually the contacts that you'll make from doing that are probably like way worth it in the long run. But there's a lot of difference between that and doing some random piece of remote work for an agent who says he's going to push you nonstop and then you never hear anything more from them.
It's to be wary about who's selling you the dream.
100%.
And in just, I think in terms of just get a lot of perspective. And I think there's just, for example, when I'm talking to various different analysts, coming out of uni and stuff and talking, and just I say multiple times, and I'm sure you'd echo this, is just prepare yourself for that gap where you're gonna have to go work something else, or you're gonna have to really smash in on writing about what you want to do in the future.
Yeah,
because it is a big gap until you land that, and then
you're making a lot of money a lot of the time.
Agreed. In terms of even when you're opened to that new landscape, you've still got to fight a lot for your kind of deals and stuff.
Analysis work is criminally underpaid. There's certain things I would recommend. One would be to not have those high expectations and to enjoy what you do as a hobby. And then if it transforms itself into something bigger than that, then great. If it doesn't, then well, you're enjoying what you're doing and that's fine too. You've got to have the income to pay your bills and stuff aside from your expectations in this industry, at least to start with. And
do you think writing helps that in terms of you creating your Substack? And I think I've found it with creating content and creating this podcast that it makes it a bit fun as well, in terms of I can have discussions like this and you can kind of test your theories and stuff in quite a low risk example. Like in terms of if a young analyst goes out and writes a blog, that's, you would have done something rather than if you're waiting for something to come up.
100%. So you're proactive. And I think it helps for me, like writing stuff helps you become accountable for your points of view. And I guess like, you could say this in like a kind of a podcast environment as well. Like, you know, if you're more sort of verbally driven than writing, then this is your product. This is where you come across. You're being judged on what the content that you put out, whether it's written or YouTube videos or whatever it might be. But that's fine, because that's the only way you're going to build a reputation. Because you're not going to get anywhere if you just sit on your hands.
I think, and that's key for in terms of young people listening, to how you've got to try really hard to express your theories and just analyze anything.
Yeah, and I've gone down like hundreds of rabbit holes looking at like trying to work out what works and what doesn't work. Some of the time I'll be like, okay, well that wasn't what I expected, but. The learning is that it's actually something that's not actually that valuable in terms of perhaps like a squad balance or something like that, or a certain type of skill set. And so even disproving something has value. Disproving a theory. And literally, I just would recommend anyone just to play around with numbers try and work out what works, what doesn't work, what are the kind of common denominators between teams that do well or teams that do badly, even, and that would, I feel like that would be a really valuable usage of someone's time. And then they write about that, and then you never know who starts reading stuff. Now, I mean, even now, I'll tell you right now, it's difficult. It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy. You like,
but I think that's important not to sugarcoat it.
It's not like football.
It's a tough industry, for sure.
In football, if you put good content out, you're going to get hired and you're going to be competed over very, very quickly. It's not like that in cricket. Interesting. Like, there's
a different market.
There's still certain coaches who, if I got the opportunity to work for them, I wouldn't even want necessarily, the money wouldn't necessarily be the main driving factor. Because I would back,
because you want, my you back want to be able to be talking about your theories and talking about your analysis.
Once I'm in front of someone, I back myself to for them to then be like, right, I'll take him everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to get to that stage first.
Mm.
So, I mean, like, an interesting
battle to lead up to that.
I don't really believe in like intern jobs that much in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, working for nothing.
Mm.
It's tough
because you are doing a lot of work for a company or a business to take advantage of you in a sense.
Yeah.
For sure. But it is a tough toss up.
Yeah. But also like it kind of benefits certain people over others and things like that. And it's, you know, your background dictates a lot in that respect. And actually, I do think that everyone's work has value. But I do think that there are certain situations whereby if you do get an opportunity, it could be a really good one. It could lead to a lot more. But those opportunities are few and far between.
It's a very negative way, but a very realistic way to end the podcast. Just both of us.
You don't want to sugarcoat. And actually, but the positive side of things is that the skills that you develop going forward by doing this, even if you don't really get anywhere, actually are super applicable for other industries as well.
Like, massively.
I know people who were working in cricket, or they tried to work in cricket and they really struggled to get jobs. And now they're working in football.
Yeah.
I know that.
So understanding the base principle of analysis, you can move in so many other directions.
100%. So like, I know that, for example, there's people who are now no longer working in cricket and they end up like doing jobs in like industry. You know, like for a commercial company. I even know someone who joined the police as an analyst after being working in cricket, you know? And the skills that you learn are actually a really good background for working in other industries. You know, like I 100% could tell you that, like, if I could work in certain other industries. I could work in like casino management in like no time at all, because I understand how the maths will work with it, and I understand how, like,
the human psychology as well around that environment,
but in line with the mathematics of analytics and stuff as well. Yeah, be so easy. Like, even like, when my wife was working, like, she'd be doing all this like audits and stuff like that, and I'd be like, she'd have like a massive spreadsheet in front of her, and I'd be like, why don't you just do this, and then you'll be able to find out who's doing things they shouldn't be doing or something like that, you know?
When you look at from a lot of things and you just try to work out how you can automate processes, it can speed a lot of just like day-to-day tasks up
100%.
Really quickly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Dan, for coming on the podcast. I think this has been my longest episode so far, but it's been really, really interesting. We'll have to do a part two at some point. But thank you very much. And I hope this winter period goes well and your recovery goes well. And I hope you have a good summer.
Yeah, it's been great to come on. Thanks, Andrew, for having me. And look forward to catching up in the summer, definitely.
Brilliant. See you soon, Dan.